Thanks again to Roman. That's right. It helped us open a meeting. And I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome those that have joined us since we first started. Warm welcome to any visitors that are with us tonight, and a massive welcome to any newcomers that might be in a room with us. We hope you're going to hear something that will encourage you to keep coming back. Okay, guys, so we do have a speaker tonight. It falls on me to introduce them. I have to confess, I don't know much about this individual, other than the fact that he's visiting us from California. He celebrated a not insignificant milestone in his recovery at the beginning of this month. We had a bit of a chat at the end of the meeting the other night, and I'm really looking forward to hearing his story. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce you to Michael. He's going to share his experience, strength and hope with us for 40 or 45 minutes, whatever he's comfortable with, and his journey to, into and through Narcotics Anonymous. So, Michael, the floor is yours, my friend. Please share with us. Thank you.
Absolutely, Steve. Thank you so much for such a warm welcome. I don't know if I can follow that introduction or not, but I'll do my best. You know, I welcome if you're new or if you're, as I like to call it, batshit crazy out of your mind. That's one of the billion things I found about Narcotics Anonymous. Is we don't care how you show up to your first meeting or your first introduction to Narcotics Anonymous, just that you have a desire to stop using all mind and mood altering things. And I am a grateful addict, and I'd always been curious, like for years, if there was an actual meaning according to the internet, you know, what is a grateful addict? So I had actually looked it up, what was it, day before yesterday, and it says, being a grateful addict means appreciating the gifts you receive every day, no matter how small, and using your addiction as a springboard to a better life than ever before. And for myself, when I first got clean, I would always hear, you have to let go, you know, you need to become willing, have faith in following the step, that by doing so, it would lead me to a life beyond my wildest dreams, and no doubt about that, that it certainly has. My clean date, including today, is June 3rd, 1986, so as Steve indicated, I recently celebrated 37 years, or I have an app that tells me, you know, days, minutes, seconds. It's 13,519 continuous days clean. The only way that I've been able to do that is by love and acceptance of my fellow addicts, a higher power that I choose to call Dude. My higher power's name is Dude, and if I have, feel like I have time, I'll get into the story as to why I call him Dude. I guess part of it is an homage of me reinventing myself when I lived over in Hawaii, telling everybody that I was on the pro surfing, at which I was nowhere close to that, but still we do whatever we need to feel like we need to do to be accepted by those around us. One of the greatest challenges that I face, my share kind of jumps around a little bit, but the message is still will still be clear, hopefully, for everybody. One of the things, the hardest things I've experienced being clean and in recovery was back in 1999 when my father passed from horrific cancer, you know, and it, my father, rest his soul, was definitely one of my using buddies, and being very much knee deep in my addiction back then, I didn't even think about the fact that it was kind of odd to be using with your own father. But the reason I did was he made a lot of money back then, and so he would always offer to pay for whatever drugs we were doing. It was like cocaine and weed and, you know, top shelf booze and stuff, and I let him do that because my thinking as a using dope fiend was, well, I'll let Pops pay for it so that way I won't have to get into my own stuff. So I would do whatever I would do with my father. Then I would still have mine to go into after I was done using with him on a particular, you know, evening or whatever, you know. I didn't care thing one about my health back then. Point in case would be the day I went to a 28-day treatment program initially in a hospital, you know, because that's what I needed. And when I did the initial interview with the intake doctor, you know, I absolutely had a moment of clarity and and honestly told him what I had been doing to myself for all those years. And he just had this look of almost like, well, I guess you could say disbelief on his face. And after I was done and he said, anything else, Michael? I said, no, Dr. Woodward, that's about it, sir. And he said, you know, I've been a doctor for, I think he had said at that point, like 27, 28 years. And he said, by all medical, and he used air quotes, by all medical reasoning, should have died a long time ago. But now today, obviously, I know that there is something greater in store for me than I could have ever hoped to realize back then, you know. And my favorite thing, and it's just this addict, I'm not speaking for NA as a whole, certainly, but my favorite thing that I've read, that I've heard from a speaker, that's been printed on NA literature, it's printed on NA literature, is the one line, I mean, of all probably hundreds of speakers I've heard, is in the Just for Today, where the line is, I think it's like 3/4 of the way through the Just for Today, where it says, you know, just for today, I will be unafraid. That line right there is, like, for me, the most powerful thing I've heard since day one of being clean. Just because, you know, as long as I'm not afraid, then the willingness will come into my life to, you know, to work this, continue to work the steps and to persevere and to pick up that phone when the addict calls me who wants to use at 3:30 in the morning, you know. And I've softened up as I get older physically and older in recovery. What I mean by that statement is I'm not as hardcore as I used to be. I would never say, you know, I've always despised, and it's we're all allowed our own opinion, but the term NA Nazi, I think that's one of the worst things I've ever heard. But I used to be pretty serious about, well, it says this and this piece of literature, that and that piece of literature, so that's the way it needs to be, you know. But I realized that everybody has their own higher power, that every meeting has its own higher power, and it doesn't matter. Things are going to go the way that they're supposed to go, as far as like meeting nomenclature or something like that, you know. Little briefly about my use in history, there is a point to where, you know, I'm a fit, in shape, 320-pound individual, but when I first got clean, you know, at that intake, you know, they weigh you and take blood and urine samples. I was 174.5 pounds. So I like to think that, you know, I've gained a whole small person of weight in recovery. What is that? Like, I've gained 145 pounds in recovery. You know, and my disease took me to those places that when I look back at it now, I'm lucky to have survived going to those, you know, houses where you do a special, I call it the secret squirrel knock. You know, you got to do a series of different, you know, how you bang on the door type of thing, and the slit it open in the door and you'd see half an eyeball looking back out at you and everything. And one of my favorite, probably my favorite comedian of all time, so right on the money described my using, because he was definitely one of us and he battled with his own addictions. And unfortunately, he took his own life. But the comedian Robin Williams, I remember once saying, you know, he was talking about that he realized he was doing too much cocaine one night when his dog tapped him on the shoulder and said, Robin, I would have barked if there was somebody actually out there, you know, and I can absolutely relate to that type of thing, because when say any one of you would stop, I would keep going, you know. I'm just lucky to physically still be here. And, you know, as I went deeper and deeper into my addiction, I remember there was one night where I was out at kind of a bar nightclub type of thing, you know, the type of bar that they play live music on Friday, Saturday night, whatever. And so I'm sitting there and I was just a regular working Joe, but I, you know, to show try and convince everybody that I was somebody other than I actually was. I bought like the most expensive bottle of champagne, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm pouring rounds, you know, and stuff, and or glassfuls, I should say. And then all of a sudden, you know, my body just shut down, and I'll be blunt. I hope it's all right that I swear a little bit. You know, I shit myself because my body physically was shutting down rather than have like, you know, I should have had an epiphany. Hey guys, I just, you know, I shit myself. I need some help. Take me to the hospital or whatever. What I did instead, so I wouldn't quote unquote miss anything, whatever the hell that's supposed to mean, is I went into the bathroom, cleaned myself up in one of those stalls and came back out. You know, it was like kind of a style thing where if you're wearing a sweater, you kind of tie it around your waist kind of thing back then where I hung out, and sat back down right in shit-stained drawers and just kept on going because I didn't want to miss any of the action, you know, any of the drinking, just any. Didn't want to miss any. I've just had so many different experiences, you know, in recovery, you know, like higher power moments and that. And when, you know, one night, the last night that I used a point in case would be that I had, I think it was like, I don't know, $1,000, maybe $1,500 in my pocket cash, you know, and I had this opportunity come up that I was going to reinvent myself once again, move to Southern California, move to really and live in a real on a yacht in a nice like boat harbor thing, you know, right on the ocean and whatnot in Southern California. But it fell apart at the last moment, as most things did, trying to run things my way and not care about the outcome. You know, it's all for me and none for you kind of mentality I definitely had back then. So what I did was I just, you know, I had this epiphany to myself and I said, you know, Mike, you know, I just decided that I was going to go for it. And, you know, if I was still alive at the end, then I was. If I wasn't, you know, at that point, I felt so bad about myself that I didn't care what the hell happened to me, you know. Because like I said, again, when everybody else would stop around me, I would keep going. If it was drinking, if it was smoking weed, if it was doing cocaine, whatever the drug of choice was for the moment, you know, I would do. I had plenty of offers, you know, to use a needle if it was heroin, if it was, you know, all the other injectables, if it was meth, you know, cocaine, whatever. But that would have made me an addict, right? So I couldn't do that. You know, even though my nose would bleed half the time, you know, but again, I would just keep going. I did not care about myself, didn't love myself, certainly didn't respect myself, you know, by any means, by any chance of the imagination. So this particular night, like I said, you know, at least $1,000, probably more than that, and I just started making the rounds. I started out first part of the day, I think it might have been by late morning, maybe by like noon. I went to this person to get some stuff. I went to that bar to have a few cocktails, you know, and to have my big thing was tequila and top shelf beer. You know, that was my go-to get down when I was drinking, is really hard tequila and imported beers. And so I started doing that and segue to about, let's call it last call. And by then, by the time I got out of that bar, it was probably 3 a.m. And I just, there's an area in Santa Rosa back then, that West 9th Street area, that it wasn't the best of neighborhoods, let's say. And so I actually physically, you know, I was at this house at one of those moments of clarity where you go, whose effing house is this? I mean, my buddy, I realized that had got me into this place, was long gone. I didn't even realize that he had left, obviously, right? So I'm there by myself. I'm in a house that I didn't know anybody. There was, you know, some of those hardcore addicts still left going at it or whatever. And so I left that place. I physically ran, took off running from West 9th Street area all the way up to the very end of this other area called 4th Street. And it was at least probably a few miles, you know. But, I mean, I was so lit for sound that I didn't even realize what I was doing, you know. And so I stopped. There's this gas station on this corner, and it was so long ago that it actually had a phone booth, the kind with the accordion door type of thing, right? And there was some shrubbery kind of hiding the bottom third, maybe half of it, on one side, you know. So I got in there. I had like a few bucks left. I know less than $100. I don't know, $40, $50 left in some phone change. So what I did was, I just had this epiphany to myself. It's like, dude, you gotta freaking do something about your life or something to that effect. And so I called my mom and told her what was going on. I could hear, you know, son knows. Is mom's voice, and she was, I could just tell that she was just terrified, you know. So I told her where I was at. She knew where I was. She drove from Sonoma to Santa Rosa, which was give or take about 25, maybe 30 minutes tops drive. She came and got me. I was so skinny back then that, you know, the space behind the two front seats, how there's like, you know, the floor of the back seat and then that little hump. I was skinny enough to lay down across that hump, you know. I wouldn't even try it nowadays, right? So I told her what was going on, you know, and I said, you know, I just, I need help, Mom. I said, your son's going to die if he keeps going the way he's going or something to that effect. So I think it was within, I don't remember exactly, like 3 days later, that it was mostly my mom's work, obviously, but we found that 28-day hospital treatment program. I checked myself in, and I thought, well, I told everybody that I was going, you know, pulling another geographic and moving back to Hawaii and whatnot. But check this. So I whoever dropped you off at the place, it was in one of the wards of the hospital. You know, they had the atypical double big doors, you know, and whoever brought you there, they had to say goodbye to you at, literally drop you off at these set of doors. And when I walked in, very first thing that happened was, and there is no accidental anythings, I believe, is this gal that I used to use with came from a very prominent, uber wealthy family in the area that I lived in. She's like, oh, Michael, oh my God, you made it. I was hoping that one day I'd see you in recovery. And I'm like, ah, get away from me, you know, because she came running up, wanted to hug on me, you know, and like that. And then some of the fellas that were in there, it was a co-ed thing. They came up, started to try and hug me. I'm thinking, a dude, take a hug from a dude? What are you kidding me? From where I came from, you know, that just was not done, you know, type of thing. But I know now, obviously, today, that when somebody offers to give me a hug, is that it's out of true gratitude, heartfelt, so grateful to see your face in recovery, you know. And I'm still around, and people on time to time have asked me, you know, you've been clean so long, Michael, and it's like the only thing I claim to know is that I've been blessed to be able to continually follow what's been shown to me to work by those that have come before me. Not that I know all and see all, certainly not. But, you know, I know for a fact, and I know how addicts' minds work when I say this, that some will think, oh, that's bullshit, you don't know. But I do know that if I am one of the addicts, okay, that choose, because I never accidentally use anything. I know the word slip is more from the other main 12-step program that honestly gave us our start, Narcotics Anonymous. But if I choose to go out and use, that I will be one of the addicts that don't make it back. I mean, don't ask me what it is, but I just have this feeling, you know. So I do daily things in my life of recovery to keep me focused, and I'm not saying that I'm perfect. Of course I have my days. So example would be, say, about, I've had the same sponsor for I think now 29 years, because he continually shows me new and different ways for me to have love and acceptance for myself. But we went to this meeting in Marin County, which is, call it a half hour drive. No, actually, it would have been about a 40-minute drive because I went up to Santa Rosa and picked my sponsor and then down to San Rafael. Anyway, we're coming back. There's this one part of the freeway where you're going straight and then you kind of dip, go down this downgrade or whatever and come up the other side type of thing. And so here I am feeling all spiritually on fire. My sponsor and I are talking about, oh, wasn't that so-and-so a great speaker in the Nooner meeting? And I'm like, yeah, that was really cool and this and that. But instantaneously, you know, this cat cuts me off on the freeway. And the only reason I'm laughing, everybody, is because next thing I knew, you know, I punched the vehicle. I forget. I think I had a Denali. Yeah, it was a Denali back then. And I catch up to this guy on the freeway with my sponsor less than half an arm's length away sitting right next to me. I reach, like, my sponsor's not even there. I reach past him. And I honk and make sure the guy, you know, I get his attention. And I flip this guy off with my sponsor sitting right next to me. Probably not the best thing I've ever done in recovery, you know. And obviously, you know, as the saying goes, or it's the one I'll use at this moment to, you know, talk about his reaction is, I didn't hear the end of it until, you know, I dropped him off about a half hour, maybe 35 minutes later, because he was right. You know, this guy could have pulled out a gun and shot me or shot both of us, you know, or something crazy like that. And to put my sponsor like that in possible harm's way is, you know, unforgivable. So, I mean, I did some praying and he had me do some writing about why I felt like I had to react in that way, you know. And there were other times, too, that, you know, been through exceptional difficulties. It's like my father, who I talked about momentarily earlier at the start of my share, he developed severe cancer, his melanoma cancer. You know, it got into his system. They gave him 4 months to live. He lived actually a year and a quarter past what they told him that he should have. Because even though he was nowhere near the program, my dad in his own way had his own epiphany and looked up everyone possible that he felt he had wronged or mistreated or whatever, you know, business dealings that were kind of a little maybe sketchy. And he called it, he wanted to apologize to all those individuals. So if he was not going to make it, he started to beat the cancer and went into remission. Then it came back stronger, twice as strong before, and took him out. I watched my father go from 230 pounds, even though he was using and drinking, he still ran on the beach 3 to 4 miles every other day. I mean, he was a using dope fiend himself, but he was in a fit, really fit shape dope fiend, I guess you could say. But he had to end up going into a hospice cancer ward. And as anyone knows, if you're in hospice, you know, you have signed a thing that basically says you realize in layman's terms that you're not going to make it, that you will die and stuff. And that was hard for my father to do, but he relented and did that. And the hardest, man, this always gets me. The thing that I was able to do because of Narcotics Anonymous and was when it was apparent that he definitely was on his way out, it was, I think, yeah, it was 4 days before he actually passed from this life and was needed in the next, as I like to think of it, is his favorite hospice nurse. Everybody was gone or taking a break, getting food or whatever they were doing that day. It was down in Santa Barbara, which is Southern California, like on the beach and stuff. And so his favorite hospice nurse, I couldn't leave my dad's side. You know, I was sitting, it was like right in the movies. I was sitting at the chair at the end of the bed, just staring at my father, like, get up, man, let's go, you know, let's go fishing or whatever I'm thinking. But, what had happened was, is he was, like I said, he ended up passing 4 days after that, but his favorite hospice nurse pulled me aside in the room that next to his that happened to be empty. He said, "Michael, I know it's going to be difficult, but somehow you have to find a way to tell your father that it's okay to go, you know, that you're going to be all right." And because, and I said, I'll try, but why is that? He said, because even though some people want to let go and see their loved ones on the other side and all that goes along with that, especially with men, you know, meaning the father or the husband, you know, they feel like they need to hang on and make sure everything's in place and make sure people want for nothing and stuff. And so he left myself and my dad alone in the room. My dad was on such heavy medication that the cancer had taken his ability to be able to speak. But what I was able to do was to lay down next to my father, and I have no shame in saying, you know, I kind of cuddled up next to him, and even though he couldn't speak, I whispered in his ear, I said, "Dad, it's all right, it's just let go." And go be with grandma and grandpa. Your son's going to be all right. And even though he couldn't speak, you know, I was holding on to him, but at some point, obviously, right, I had to let go of him, and I did, and I looked at my father, and tears were coming down one side. So even though he couldn't speak at that point because of the cancer taking, like I said just a second ago, took his ability to speak, is that he did hear me, you know. And before that, like I said, he lived like actually a year past what they'd given him. As I had said, they'd given him 4 months to live, but he lived a year past that. So he lived a year and a quarter past what they had told him. So in that time, I had done my amends with my father when he was still able to walk and talk. You know, he lived like at most 4 or 5 minute walk from this pristine, beautiful beach, you know, and it's kind of a higher end area. So on the beach, they had these, like, not sure if I'm pronouncing this right, but Adirondack chairs, you know, these big beach chairs with windbreak, like little miniature wall things. So I found this perfect one. We're looking at the ocean. You know, together, I took care of my amends with my father right then and there, you know. So when he did go and went to the other side, you know, I was clean with my father. I had no regrets. And all I can do, again, I don't know all and see all. What I can share with you all this evening is, if you're thinking about, well, I have plenty of time to take care of my spiritual business with this person, or my uncle so-and-so, or aunt so-and-so, or my mom, or, you know, my brother Bob, or whatever the situation is, you don't have the time. I mean, they could be gone tomorrow, because obviously I didn't expect my pops to get cancer and watch him whittle away to nothing. You know, he was from 230, like I said, down to 142 and a quarter by the time he passed, you know. But here's another spiritual thing is, so in the last, when he, because he is in a hospice ward, they have you hooked up. So when you do take your last breath, or I guess actually breath or heartbeat or whatever, they have this machine that notates like the exact time to the, literally to the second. And so he passed. And then when we all kind of, you know, kind of realized there's so many people down there staying in, you know, hotels or friends' houses or something like that, you know, when we all started to get together, you know, to decide, you know, what to do and carry out his last wishes and, you know, that type of thing, is we all talked about, well, hey, you know, I had this weird dream thing or whatever. I woke up at whatever the time was, say it was 5:11 in the morning or something. I don't remember what the time was, but we all talked about it, and we all just naturally got woken up. Either it was by, we had a dream, or some people claimed it was a nightmare, but we all talked, all of us, there was like 40, maybe 50 of us down there. We all realized that we all woke up at the same time the exact time that my father was documented by hospice as passing away. So, you know, figure, you know, whatever you think about that is whatever you want to think about that. But it was a wild thing. So we took care of, you know, his last wishes. The guy that he worked for, he's a right-hand kind of planner guy for a super wealthy individual. You know, this guy had this beautiful old school, large, long yacht. My dad wanted to be cremated, so he was. And we, those of us, you know, I have two sisters, older and a younger sister, myself. So we were each given by the, I don't know what they call it, but I'll call it the funeral place or whatever, a thing of his ashes. And to this day, I still have a thing, my dad's ashes. And before I'm too old to travel, talking about jumping around, when I was 14, my dad and I took a small plane into a runway by this great fishing lodge in Wyoming. We went fishing for, what was it, four days straight, caught like 70 fish in 4 days of fishing, brought enough back with us to feed everybody at a family reunion, you know, and there was my dad and I holding court at the end of this long dining table telling story after story after story, you know. Obviously, a lot was embellished, but it was the coolest thing. And why I bring that up is my father, until the last day, like I said, he stopped being able to talk 4 days, up until 4 days before he actually passed. He was always saying that he and I, once he got better and got out of there, we were going to go back to that, take a trip back to that same place. And all I said was, absolutely, Dad, I so look forward to it, you know. I was clean with my father when he passed. And that's what I can recommend to everybody is, even though it's a scary thing, or, you know, some addicts at this meeting tonight, are probably thinking, well, fuck my dad or fuck, you know, my uncle or whatever. But all that matters is what I've learned in Narcotics Anonymous is all I need to worry about is what was told to me. So I was more easily able to understand was all I need to worry about is sweeping my own side of the street and keep my side clean. You know, if the other person comes around, they do. If they don't, then at least I will have a clear conscience with that, you know, particular individual. So what I am going to do is, X number of years later, you know, I was working for a high-end car service, driving, you know, chauffeuring the la-di-da people of life around, and I ran into this guy that I still have his contact information. It's been several years, but I still have his contact information, that knows the exact spot. He's from Wyoming, okay? Not only that, but he knows the exact spot that I was speaking of. And I told him the story or whatever, you know, and he said, Michael, when you're ready, as long as it takes, here's my direct contact information. Let's make that happen to you, because I will spread my dad's ashes out at that same fishing site one of these days, like I said, before I'm too old to travel, or, you know, it's my time to go to the other side or whatever, you know. Because that'll be like coming around full circle for me, that situation. You know, I've dealt with a lot of, I used to be so angry up until however many years ago about that this disease has taken so many loved ones of mine, meaning so many friends of mine in Narcotics Anonymous, but there's nothing I can do. Addicts make their own choices. You know, I can't force, as much as I literally used to want to literally choke the program into some people. I'm kind of laughing, but I'm mostly serious. You know, I used to be like, you know, I never could get like it. I mean, steps can be difficult if I make them difficult, okay? They can have power over me if I allow it to, or if I, think about, well, I used to think, and I first got clean, especially even though I was in treatment for 7 months of the first year I was clean, I thought, well, if I let go of whatever this character or that character defect is, who am I going to be? Because I had been that person, that using addict, that the mischievous, conniving, manipulative. When I think of how many hours I would spend listening to your bullshit, because I knew eventually if I hung out long enough, you would break out your bag so I wouldn't have to go into mine, I would do it. I mean, I'd sit around for 5-6 hours because, like I said, it worked every time, what I dealt with in recovery, and some of the cool higher power moments is, so for instance, I went through the long-term treatment. First, I went through the hospital thing, and then when you were going to get out like that next day or something, they would do this ceremony where they would have everybody stand in like a circle, and anybody that felt like it, staff and residents, included men and women, would say, would be brutally honest, like, Michael, I think you need to work on this or that. But, it was mostly, I got a certificate that said, I forget exactly, but it said something about you are now a certified human being. Nobody ever told me that I was basically a worthwhile person. Or if they did, it didn't resonate, no doubt. I've been to a lot of funerals in this program. I mean, the anger part that I alluded to a moment ago was I was so angry that I felt like my higher power, my dude, was taking these people away from me. But, I realized, like I said, again, just a second ago, is that addicts make their own choices. One of the hardest hits I took, it was a couple of years ago, a friend of mine that when he was doing his NA thing and working his steps and showing up to meetings regularly, he was the kind of energy that when he'd walk in to a meeting, the whole room just would light up. He had that kind of intoxicating positive energy. But he was like, a Jekyll and Hyde type of addict. I mean, when he went down that dark rabbit hole, I mean, it was knee deep, primordial ooze level darkness that would come over him. Not that I ever sponsored this cat, but, he did. He would call me. One time I remember it, my cell phone rang, always keep it right next to me on my little nightstand thing in case that addict does call that needs to talk to me or whatever. So one time he did call me, it was 3:37, I remember, even though it was a few years ago, 3:37 in the morning. And he's just, I knew he was higher than a Georgia pine is a stain we have here in the States, meaning I don't think it was possible that he got any more loaded. So that being said, he just said, Big Mike, and I can say his name because he is passed. What's up, Brother Jake? And he just said, what's the point of going on and all this distraught, despondent type of thing? And I said, there was nothing that I could do. I mean, it wasn't the right thing for me to take the hour drive from Sonoma to go. He lived in San Francisco, It wasn't for me to get in the vehicle. And I said, Jake, I love you, brother. I'm definitely going to pray for you. But even if I had gotten into a conversation or something, he wouldn't have heard it because he was so high, it wouldn't have resonated. I said, brother, when you come down and after you've slept for however long you need to sleep, call me back. And he did. It was like a day and a half, maybe two later. He did. Somehow he remembered that and called me back, But with Jake, what had happened was he was on kind of one of his straight and narrow times, when he was on the path of recovery, just out of the blue, he was going to one of the universities in San Francisco, and he and this gal that he was there at school with, they went to whoever the dealer was, and they got some stuff, some cocaine, and they did it, and it was fine. She went back to class, but Jake went back to this guy, wherever he was, and the second go-around, the second Bendel or batch or whatever you want to call it, it was mostly fentanyl, you know. So you can, you know how the rest of the story is going to turn out. I mean, he ended up going brain dead, you know, and it was super hard for the family to pull the plug, even though there's no, that his whole team of doctors said, you know, chances of him coming, even if he didn't have any chance of any kind of, you know, recovery. So what Narcotics Anonymous has taught me is given me the strength. So I went and saw him in the last, I think, I don't know, 7 or 10 days of Jake's life. I went into the ward that he was in, and he was plugged up to, he looked bionic. He was plugged up to, plugged into so many different machines and drip things or whatever the docs call those deals, you know, where they stick a needle in your arm and gives you fluids or medicine or whatever. What I was able to do is sit by Jake's side, you know, and even though there's probably not a chance in hell he understood me, I was able to hold his hand and tell my friend how I felt about him and how much I appreciated his friendship and stuff, you know, and at one on, that was like the first day, you know, I saw him I went back like, I think 3 or 4 times during the last, I don't know, 7 or 8 days of his life, you know. I think it was the last time I went, you know, I was just, you know, like I said, I was just holding his hand and telling him again, you know, repeating the same things I had the previous few times I had gone there. Just out of the blue is his mom, his two sisters and I, they were sitting across, he was in a big private room. I just grabbed Jake's hand, you know, I was holding it, and I said, Jake, what the fuck have you done, man, like that, you know, and I'm not making this up, as sure as I'm talking to you all tonight. It was like Jake, all of a sudden, out of the blue, like, sat halfway up. He didn't really open his eyes, but it's like he threw all the dead brain, whatever, or however you want to put it, through what he was physically going through. Somehow he must have heard me because he did his best to sit. He sat about a third to halfway up after I said that, like, what the hell is going on? What have you done? You know, or something like that. Somehow it got through the myriad of dead brain matter or whatever. And, but then he just fell back down to the bed, and we all, like, we didn't freak out, but I was just like, holy shit, you know, type of moment, you know. I've had sponsees in this life of recovery, and I haven't. I have never fired anyone except for one guy. And I have myself time, so I'm getting towards the end here, so I'll pick it up a little bit. I got about 3 minutes left or so. So this guy, long story short, you know, he was constantly late. He wouldn't show up for when we agreed to meet to work on this or that suggested step. Or recovery writing thing. Went to my sponsor. I said, sponsor, this is what's going on. My sponsor said, all right, Big Mike, you know, try this thing. And I try that thing. And so I did this back and forth like 3 different times. And on the third time, I said, I don't know what to do. And he said, at this point, Big Mike, you need to let him go. So I did the stand-up thing because my feelings matter, right? I pulled this guy aside at a meeting, and I said, so-and-so, you know, it's just time for me. I mean, I said, brother, give me a hug. So I gave him a hug, and with one hand on my shoulder, on his, one of his shoulders, I took my hand off of him. I said, brother, it's time that you go this way, you know, kind of motion with my hand, like to the right. I said, it's time for me to go that way. Instantly, he got in my face, physically came at me aggressively 3 different times. And I had to work through it, but I said, brother, I've respected your boundaries, but you've come at me aggressively 3 different times. You come at me again, and basically, I was frustrated that I threatened him back, and, you know, I made amends for that. But, you know, I said, he said, I'm going to kick your ass, Big Mike, and this and that. But what I was able to do is Narcotics Anonymous had taught me that it doesn't make me any more or less of a man if I apologize for my actions. It just means that I wanted to get rid of that negativity out of my soul So who knows? They could have possibly got me to act out even more inappropriately, you know. And lastly, I'm so grateful for this opportunity. I feel so blessed and honored to share for you all this evening. And the very last thing I'll say is, you know, I'm an addict, right? I don't have, do you know anyone in your life, whoever's listening, do you know anyone that goes, yay, I have everything I want 110% of the time? I'd be absolutely surprised if anyone said yes to that question. I don't have everything I want because I'm an addict. But since moment one of me raising my hand that very first time and saying, you know, I'm an addict, it took me a while to say grateful addict. I've been given everything I need. And with that, I'm out. Thank you again so much for allowing me to share at your meeting. Thank you.